What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Today's State Terror Roundup is a little bit different. See, state terror isn't just about police violence. It is all the violence of the state, which includes the fallout from the protected system of white supremacy that goes unchecked and unabated. This is the State Terror Roundup for July 9th, 2026. On July 4th, Northern Wells, a black teenager, traveled to Horn Island with a group of white boys that he called friends to celebrate Independence Day. Independence for not black folks, but Nolan was there with his friends to celebrate. Nevertheless, the boat left from a private dock in the Ocean Springs area, according to the sheriff, John Ledbetter. At some point in time, the friends say Nolan walked off and they assumed he found another way home or he stayed back because he was going to catch a ride. But Nolan, was the only one who never made it home. And now the boys he traveled with say they don't know. They have no idea. We thought it was with other people. Online, scores of black mothers and fathers are saying, this is why I don't or I never, I will never allow my black child to be alone with a group of white folks. They are citing the cases of Shanquilla Robinson, who died on October 9, 2022, while on a vacation with six of her so-called friends, and Kanika Jenkins, 19 years old black woman from Chicago, Illinois, who died after becoming trapped inside of a commercial walk-in freezer partying with people that she called friends. Tamla Horsford was discovered dead in the backyard of the Cumming, Georgia home where she had been attending a slumber party with other football moms the night before. The 40-year-old was a mother of five. The list goes on and on. Black bodies mysteriously ending up dead after being seen or hanging out with, traveling with, sleeping next to. White folks is as old as the days they publicly lynched us without apology or shame. Now they gotta hide it or try to. We have babies swinging from trees on college campuses and in neighborhoods like 27-year-old Tunia Nicole Miller, who was found hanging from a tree near Gwen Cherry Park in Miami, Florida. This State Terror Roundup was a PSA to my black beloveds. They are hunting us. They are killing us. They are hunting our children. They are killing our children. I bring up again baby Wiley, who was murdered after being shown to police by police. He was 1 year old. He was gunned down in a Walmart parking lot for alleged shoplifting. They are hunting us and they are killing us, and they are doing it with a smile on their face. They are doing it with an assuredness that the law is on their side because they know their president is their soldiers in the purification project that is ravaging this country and disappearing black and brown bodies to the tune of thousands a month into American concentration camps by ICE. Safety, especially right now for our people, for our children, is an illusion. We are all we got. It is our duty and charge to protect them and each other. Black blood runs through every letter in the word Mississippi. Our blood soaks the soil and our ancestors haunt the air. They about to roll Nolan Wells' death an accident. They already setting it up, sheriff saying he drowned, by one of the boys who was with Nolan on that day. His stepmama is a judge and she did a whole social media post to dispel the rumors with facts. She said, how does she have facts? She wasn't there. But the fact that she's a judge, y'all pay attention to that one. She's a judge. They are telling us black bodies swinging from trees in Florida where there are billboards promoting lynchings are suicides. Wake up, beloveds. Get active. Join an organization. Keep your heads on a swivel. They are coming for us. Stay ready. I love you. Accountability now for Northern Wells, Baby Wiley, Tonia Miller, Tamla Hansford, Kanika Jenkins, Shanquilla Robinson, and a whole host of names I don't know or have time to name. May you haunt your murderers with fervor and ferocity. Goddamn, Mississippi. Mississippi, goddamn. This has been the State Terror Roundup for July 9th, 2026. State Terror Roundup, soundtrack by Coffee Brown. And that takes us to 8:12 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn.
We're a little behind on that one, but that seemed appropriate.
And I mean every word of it. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about
Mississippi Goddamn by Nina Simone, playing in honor of Baby Wiley murdered in a Walmart parking lot in Senatobia, Mississippi by police. And of course, Nolan Wells, who was missing, that they are now saying drowned after he went to celebrate Independence Day with a group of white kids. Also in Mississippi. So that takes us to 8:13 in the morning here on Law & Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. Unaccompanied minors are being targeted, arrested, and deported at alarming numbers, upwards of 10,000 a month, according to a new analysis by ProPublica. Here to discuss their article, "These Immigrant Kids Were Once Protected Under Trump, Their Deportations Have Tripled." Longer name of the article is first of its kind, ProPublica Analysis. Unaccompanied minors living in the U.S. are removed three times the rate of the last time Donald Trump was in office. We're joined by Micah Rosenberg, an investigative reporter on ProPublica's national desk focusing on immigration, and Jeff Ernsthausen.
Ernsthausen.
Hey there. A senior data reporter at ProPublica. Jeff specializes in using data analysis and codes to find stories. Good morning to you both, and thank you for joining us today. We have a packed show in short time, so I want to get right into it. For folks who may not know, I mean, I didn't know actually what the metrics were. How do you identify an unaccompanied minor? Like, what are the qualifications, for lack of a better word, in this moment, that the state would say, yes, you have unaccompanied minor status? And once they get that status, what is that supposed to mean?
Well, you know, unaccompanied minors are kids who have crossed the U.S.-Mexico border by themselves without any parents or legal guardians, and they've come into the U.S., and usually kids that have come from farther away places from Mexico and, you know, farther away from than Mexico or Canada are usually let into the U.S. and held in shelters until they can be released to sponsors in the United States and sort of start their immigration process. This is because this group of kids is seen as particularly vulnerable. They come by themselves. They can be vulnerable to, you know, trafficking and other harms. And so they're sort of a special system for them. And so what we found is that in U.S. immigration data itself, these children are actually marked as they move through the system. And so that was what Jeff was able to identify.
Jeff, what does she mean by marked as they move through the system?
So ICE keeps track of everyone in its detention system. And so these unaccompanied minors were labeled as unaccompanied minors in data that we received through a Freedom of Information Act request.
Let's use a story. You center your story. There are thousands of kids, and we'll get into the numbers, but the sort of the cornerstone of your story is as a baby. I know they say 18, for me that's still a baby, in Winnefield, Louisiana, named Elder Chavez. Who is he? What is happening to him?
So Elder is sort of typical of these types of kids who have come into the U.S. He was actually in Honduras. He was abandoned by both of his parents when he was a toddler. He was living with an aunt, but his older sister was in the U.S. and had established a life in Alabama. She had, you know, a husband and children, and wanted him to come and live with her, you know, to have a better life here. And so when he was 14 years old, he crossed the border by himself, came into the country, and was released to his sister. And him, like other, you know, kids who've come in that way, there's some special protections under U.S. law where if you can prove in a family court that you've been abandoned or abused or neglected by, you know, your parents, and you can prove that there's somebody here who can take custody of you, you can apply for something that's called special immigrant juvenile status. And so this, you know, Elder went through that. He applied, he was approved. And once you're approved for this, you sort of get in this line to actually apply for a green card and stay here permanently. And so he was in that line, but it's a very long wait because there's a huge backlog. And so, you know, previously under the Biden administration, there was a recognition that these kids, you know, were sort of doing everything right, and while they were waiting, they should be protected from deportation. But when Trump came into office the second time, he lifted those protections. And so kids like Elder were no longer, you know, protected from being picked up by ICE. So he was actually out, you know, the day before New Year's, he went to go get a sandwich near his sister's house. He was going 15 miles over the speed limit, and Alabama police pulled him over. And once they realized that he was from Honduras, they called ICE. You know, he tried to say, look, I have this paperwork. He carried it around with him everywhere. But the officer said, look, that doesn't matter to us. And so they took him to an adult detention center because he's now 18 and he's been there in Louisiana for the past 6 months.
I'm looking at numbers and it says that your report says that minors living in the U.S. are detained and removed at three times the rate of the last time Trump was in office, which means that minors were still being detained the last time Trump was in office. This isn't a new thing. I think this might be a question for Jeff. What was the rate of detention the first go around, and did it ever really slow or stop, or did it, you know, sort of stay the same until this latest spike?
Yeah, so for the first Trump administration, to a degree, and then during the Biden administration, you know, when you would talk about unaccompanied kids, you're often talking about people who are arriving at the border. What you're seeing different now is that the Trump administration is much more focused on this mass deportation effort, which has in general meant more people being arrested, detained, and deported by ICE. And what we're seeing is that that's also affecting kids in a way that is new. So this time around, what we're seeing is Trump has arrested these kids and put them in ICE detention, removed them. Often folks accepting voluntary removal because they're, you know, for instance, folks are in these long stays, and they're deciding it's better to just, you know, stop trying to remain in the country. And that's happening at three times the rate it was during Trump's first term. During the Biden administration, it was a much lower rate. You know, we include some charts in the story that show that under Biden, there was not much, you know, interior arrests like inside the country of these kids. And then we also look at sort of in the story, we also look at the sort of broader, you know, universe of kids, not just those who came in unaccompanied, but also just kids in general. And when you look at the sort of like court data on that, you see that Trump's been removing getting removal orders from immigration judges an average of 10,000 times a month for people who are under 18. And that rate is also much higher than last time Trump was in office and higher than when Biden was in office.
That number blew my head. 10,000 a month for how many months?
That's an average across the entire time since January of 2025 that he's returned to office. Like the peak is higher than that in the last few months. I mean, the trend has been increasing generally in terms of removal orders that kids are facing every month.
Mm-hmm. So the orders. Oh, go ahead, Micah.
No, I was just going to say that those orders in court, they can come down and, you know, because it's an order from a judge, the kids can appeal and try and stay longer. But that, of course, is very expensive. You have to have a lawyer. And in the meantime, while you're waiting for that to process through the system, you have this order hanging over your head, which one attorney described to us as, you know, having a loaded gun pointed at you and that you could be picked up by ICE at any time. So while the orders are very, very high, sometimes the actual removals are lower, but it's putting all of these kids, you know, at risk of getting picked up and detained and removed at any time.
Talk about Judge Jem Sponza. I feel like she needs some attention. And what being, apparently she's been fired since you wrote this, but I was sort of struck by the rapid, you can feel it in the way you write the piece, the rapid nature with which she was just deporting children based on orders. Talk about that process for kids, and then talk about who the orders are coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and I think this is just one example of what judges are facing all over the country. So one thing that the Trump administration has done is put an extreme amount of pressure on the immigration courts, where, you know, almost all of these kids who come in, they at some point have to face a judge and make their case to stay. But that was always sort of a process that was held in a little, you know, they were given a little bit more time, they were handled with a little bit more care, they had special dockets just for these juveniles. And what's been happening is across the board, the immigration courts are under a huge amount of pressure. There's been more than 100 judges who've been fired, another 100 that have been pushed out with early retirement. A lot of the judges who've been let go believe that it's because they, you know, maybe are not in line with the administration's view of sort of denying more cases, ordering more people deported, because one of the things that the administration has done is sent a lot of instructions to judges across the country to speed up cases, to not let you know, migrants, including minors, you know, spend a lot of time trying to find lawyers or, you know, put in their applications. And so what was happening in this judge's courtroom in New York that I observed is something that we see all over the country. And, you know, in the span of 3 hours, there was, you know, about more than 24 kids who were on her docket, and almost all of them were ordered deported in a matter of minutes. You know, a lot of them, you know, citing these instructions that the judges are getting to, you know, speed it up and get these cases moving. And so we've seen sort of across the board these removal orders increase, but in, you know, getting swept up in that are our kids.
I'm just going to take a point of privilege and talk about or mention Wisconsin Judge Hannah Dugan. So the judges have a choice, right? There's different ways to put your body on the line. Some people do it in the streets. These judges have a choice whether or not to do it in the courtroom, right? Citing orders.
I think it's the judges are in a difficult position, you know, of that they're trying to follow the instructions. The thing that's interesting about these immigration judges is that they report to the Justice Department. They're an executive branch, you know, office there in the unlike judges in the federal judges in the judicial bands that have, you know, complete autonomy from the administration. So, you know, they really are subject to control by the Attorney General and the instructions from the Justice Department.
Yeah, this shows law and disorder. Me and my comrades been breaking laws for 20 years in the name of justice and freedom. So that's what time it is right now. Jeff, talk a little bit about, these are a lot of numbers. Can you talk a little bit about the accumulation of data? What was your process like?
So for this story, we relied primarily on two data sets. One was a data set of ICE detention records, which we obtained via Freedom of Information request. And that data gives you detailed, you know, path of someone as they're traveling through the detention system. And we can learn a lot about what's happening to detainees in the immigration system that way. The other data set is released every month, also via FOIA request by the Justice Department, and it shows sort of what's happening in the cases of everybody who's in the immigration system. And that's, you know, it's millions of cases that are in the immigration system at any one time, and we're able to analyze those to get a picture of what's happening to immigrants in general, and we can look at different groups, including children, which is what we examined for this story.
Micah, for the young people that are deported, where are they going? What happens to them?
Well, it's a real mix. And, you know, we've been trying to follow, you know, some of them. Sometimes kids who maybe their parents are here, or their family is here, they end up getting sent back to their homes by themselves, where they have to sort of reunite with other relatives. They're particular in Central America. There's some, you know, shelters that receive those kids when they're sent back, and then they go back with their families. Sometimes, you know, they have parents or relatives who've already been deported before them, or, you know, were already in the country and they traveled by themselves. So they go back and rejoin those families. But, you know, across the board, a lot of these kids, almost all of them came mostly in the recent years, have come from a few countries in Central America, the Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, which, you know, have been plagued with a lot of gang violence, poverty, you know, other social ills. And so a lot of kids have come here sort of seeking safety. And so if they're sent back, that's where they go back to.
Before I let you go, I want to touch on that strand, that theme of safety. Homeland Security is saying that they are keeping the kids safe because they're finding them with bad people, racists and rapists and drug traffickers, etc. True, not true?
Yeah.
Gaslighting, more gaslighting by this administration, maybe.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting sort of piece of this story because, you know, one thing that the administration points to, which is true, is that during the Biden administration, there was a record number of these kids who crossed the border, you know, more than 450,000 kids in 4 years came unaccompanied, were released into the U.S. And there were instances, you know, some of the reporting that I did before I came to ProPublica, in fact, was about some of these, you know, kids who had entered the country who ended up working in dangerous factories and in car manufacturing plants in Alabama, in meat processing plants. Some of the kids that we found were as young as 12 or 13. You know, so there is a real danger that some of these kids sort of end up in dangerous situations here. What the administration has done is said that they sort of, you know, went out and wanted to find where these kids who had been released were in the country, check on their well-being. They said that they've now located, you know, 146,000 of that, you know, group who came in under Biden. And, you know, some of them, the majority of kids who are released into the U.S. are released to their parents or to close relatives. There's a smaller number who are released to sort of more distant, you know, friends of the family. And the administration found that, you know, there were instances where the kids were fine, they were with their relatives, but they also say that they found instances where they were in danger. But when we tried to sort of drill down on the specific cases, what they said is they gave us a list of about a dozen sponsors of these unaccompanied kids who had criminal records in their past. And then they announced sort of a handful of indictments against sponsors who they charged with smuggling and in one case sexually exploiting a minor. But when we repeatedly asked sort of what happened to those children in those cases, they didn't give a response. So they didn't let us know if they had been given a trafficking visa or, you know, some sort of other protection. They just didn't tell us what happened to the kids in those cases. So what we've heard from, you know, advocates and lawyers who've worked with these minors for a long time is that, you know, they believe that the administration is sort of trying to paint a picture that, you know, the minors themselves could be criminals, the sponsors that are taking them in could be criminals, that they present a general danger to the U.S. when, you know, the vast majority are, you know, likely safer here and just trying to live out their lives.
All right, we've got to leave it there. Thank you both so much for your work and for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you
for having us.
We've been speaking with Micah Rosenberg, an investigative reporter on ProPublica's national desk focusing on immigration, and Jeff Ersthausen, a senior data reporter at ProPublica. Jeff specializes in using data analysis and code-defined stories. That takes us to 8:31 in the morning here on Law & Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. The Vallejo Police Department was finally forced to release the report about officers who bent their badges to commemorate people they had murdered. Officer Zach Jacobson, who murdered Alicia Sadler's brother, Angel Ramos, in 2017, was found to have bent badges, but remained with the department until 2023. Alicia joins us this morning. Good morning, sis. You on mute, baby. Alicia, are you there? You're on mute. We cannot hear you. Let's do a music break while we figure out the technical difficulties. We can bring in Scott, that's fine. Alicia, on Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., this coming Tuesday, July 14th, impacted families will be addressing the Vallejo City Council about the badge bending report, along with the rampant corruption that has and continues to plague the Vallejo Police Department. Will you be there, and what is your message? Sorry, I just saw Scott's Zoom picture. Will you be there, and what is your message for City Council?
Yes, I'm definitely will be there. I just want to talk about how, first of all, that Jacobson admitted to bending his badge or getting his badge bent when he murdered Angel, as well as he bent McMahon's badge after he killed Ronnell Foster, and he got to basically retire. There was no accountability, nothing. They just want to sweep it under the rug, and I'm not okay with that.
We've also been joined by Scott Morris, a journalist based in Oakland who covers policing, protests, civil rights, and far-right extremism. Scott is the editor of the article in Vallejo Sun, Vallejo Releases Investigation into Police Badge Bending 5 years after its completion. It's been a minute. Thanks for joining, Scott.
Yeah, good to be here.
Can we give some, just a little bit of context? I've got Angel's sister, Alicia, who I know you know, also on the line. How did the badge bending ceremonies come to light?
Mostly that was comes through a former police captain, John Whitney. So he kind of brought the practice to attention of superiors back in 2019 after the shooting of William McCoy. There was an officer who was on the force, Ryan McMahon, and he turned in his badge during an investigation. He actually had a plate on his gun that they discovered that they didn't like, that had some Latin phrasing on it. It was a reference to the movie Boondock Saints. And so when he turned his badge out during the investigation, they said, "Hey, this is Ben, what's going on here?" And they started looking into it. Then the captain, once he realized what was going on, he kind of brought it to the attention of superiors, but they really decided not to do anything about it. So then he started going to the city officials and kind of trying to get more attention about it. Eventually he got fired himself, because they were conducting a leak investigation. He deleted his phone in the middle of that. After that, he went to the media, and he filed a lawsuit. The allegations were contained in the lawsuit, and then he raised this with a few different media organizations in the process of filing his lawsuit. Then it just became this like scandal that just, you know, reverberated across the country. It was covered all over the place.
And I don't know if I knew this before, but it came back to my mind in reading the article that is in the Vallejo Sun right now. This is a practice that a cop brought from Contra Costa. So this didn't originate in Vallejo. It this started maybe in Contra Costa, and perhaps is more widespread than that across police departments. Maybe, we don't know.
That's the story, is that they came up with this over in Concord Police Department. It was way back in 2003. And the story goes that these two guys, Dan Golinvo and Kent Tribble, and Kent had just been involved in a shooting, and he was feeling, I guess, sad about his performance in that. He had missed a subject from like 10 yards with an assault rifle, and he felt like he hadn't performed his duties adequately. And so they were sitting around in the Peppermill restaurant, to make him feel better, the story goes that Golinvo took his badge and he bent the tip of it to kind of give him this boost in morale. And so that they said was the genesis of this whole thing. Kent Tribble according to the badge bending report, had then gone and bent his brother's badge, who was also a Concord police officer at the time. And then both Tribbles came to Vallejo a couple years later, where they kind of spread the practice there. Now, years ago, we found out about this Concord police connection, and we asked the Concord Police Department, whether they'd looked into if this was happening, if this had continued to happen. And they said that they had no evidence that there was any of this that ever happened in Concord. And I pointed to Kent Tribble testifying under oath that he had in fact done this while he was a Concord police officer. And they reiterated that they had no evidence or no reason to believe that this had ever happened.
Got 5 years, Alicia, for this report to surface. How does that make you feel? And you said you're not gonna allow, and I know there's several families, a bunch of folks are rolling up to city council on Tuesday. What does that mean for city council to not sweep this under the rug? What is it that you all would like to see?
We would like to see accountability. I feel like Jacobson should not be allowed to just retire. Like, he should not ever be able to come back to the force and be a police officer anywhere. He needs to be decertified. I wish he can go to jail for what he did. Basically, you admitted that you celebrated killing my brother, and how anybody can be okay with that, it's just, it hurts.
Alicia, Jacobson didn't just murder Angel, and the Vallejo Police Department didn't just cover it up. They terrorized you and your family, correct?
Definitely. Definitely. There was a lot of them trying to scare us. And I say trying because it didn't work. It never stopped us and never will. I'm always going to fight for my brother and continue to keep his name alive. But they definitely terrorized us for sure.
Scott, are there the police that are named in the report, are they still with BPD?
No one that had a sustained violation is. Most of the last couple left within the last few years, and one of them was, in fact, Zach Jacobson, who had a sustained violation for, spreading the practice, because that was the thing. It wasn't just that he got his badge bent, they were excusing that, but he actually went and bent another officer's badge after he had his bent. So he was, enthusiastically participating in this. And like she said, he stayed on for a few years after that, eventually retired. And then the other one would have been Officer Wiley, Sergeant Wiley, who was named Supervisor of the Year at one point during this period, I think in 2023. He was at the department up until last year and then moved on. But one of the things about this report was that a few officers, there was pretty strong evidence that they were potentially participating in this. And, there were certain leads that just weren't followed up on. So there are officers that will remain for the force to this day that there's strong questions about whether or not they're participating. I think one of them, Waylon Boyce is the one that comes to mind, because he, is interviewed in this report because he was involved in a shooting. And they say, he just says, I don't know anything about it. I don't know. I never heard of this. I never, had anything to do with it. But a few years ago, we got, which that the investigator Rob Giordano did not get, the actual records of badge repairs during the period. And that showed that Boyce had sent his badge in repair to straighten the tip above E in Vallejo. That's written on the invoice there. And so this is something that the report never followed up on, the city investigators never followed up on, and that officer remains with the force to this day.
2019, I think 2018, it felt like we were in Vallejo screaming all the time. It felt like it was murder after murder after murder after murder. That's how it feels in my body and in my brain. And then on top of the murders, there's all of the corruption and the scandals. We can even take the case of Sean Monterosa, right, who was murdered in 2020, and the vehicle that the cops shot through, right, the Police Officer Association changed out the windshield. It's just thing after thing after thing after thing. Has there been any improvement? Has there been any change, Scott Morris? Is it the same VPD that you and I have been talking about for a really long time now?
Well, I will say that there have been fewer fatal shootings since Sean Montrose. There has not been a single fatal shooting in Vallejo by Vallejo Police since 2020, since Sean Montrose. That's something, and that matters. And so I think that and there have been a couple of shooting incidents since then where the person has survived. But it's definitely been at a slower pace than there was in that period. Especially like 2011, 2012 was when it really got intense back then. But remained so through 2019, 2020. In that sense, yes, I think things have gotten better there. I think there's still a lot of problems in that department. There's still, potentially a lack of accountability for some things that we've seen. I think I was on talking about the incident with the lieutenant's golden handcuffs a few months ago, and so that situation had been happening in the background there. There was some indications a year or two ago that kind of use of force overall was going up by the Vallejo Police Department. There were some statistics that we analyzed that suggested that. It's the kind of thing that I think without kind of a constant presence, it can kind of start to become comfortable again. I think there have been improvements, but I think that it takes vigilance to maintain that.
I'm not a real journalist like you. I'm an organizer with a platform, and so my position is if a police department is operating at all, it's problematic. But that's just me. Alicia, you want to say any final words before I thank you both?
Just please, if everybody can try their best to show up and support us and let them know that we're still here and we're not going anywhere.
That's Tuesday, July 14th at 6:30. Scott, one more question for you. What could accountability look like? What could City Council do? What should they do now that this report is out? What is a realistic ask from the families?
I mean, the thing is that I don't know at this point. Like, I think that they've dragged this out for so long that they really have evaded a lot of accountability. I mean, they basically, and the timing I think is interesting that it took 5 years to get this out, and by the time they did release it, the people who had sustained violations on it, the last one I think retired, kind of sometime last year. So it was like they kind of got out the door before. This was revealed here, and I have to wonder about that timing that with that. And so it's and with the people that are there, I think that they could go back and do a better investigation, and I think that that's worthwhile to kind of have an actual accounting of this because this was poorly done. But at the same time, as far as accountability, I think they've already screwed that up because there is a statute of limitations on this. They only have so long before they find out about something to actually impose discipline on an officer, and that's 5 years later as well outside of that. So I think that they th this has kind of worked as it intended to kind of just sweep this practice aside for now. But I think that kind of ongoing changes, really, looking into the culture of the department and keeping that scrutiny up is still going to matter going forward.
That was going to be my follow-up question. This may not be fair, that maybe that is the ask, maybe that is the demand from community. It's not for me to say. I don't live in Vallejo. But maybe there are cultural practices or policies or practices of the department that can be altered to, I'm using an air quote, to prevent this kind of thing from happening in the future.
And that, I mean, culture change is a big, long-term kind of project that really requires sort of turning over a department to some level. And what you'll find is that when you look at the command staff over there, you're going to see a lot of guys that are coming up in the name the where whose names are coming up in this report. So they weren't necessarily found any wrongdoing, but at the same time, there was still questions about their conduct over there. And so But the thing is that that's another thing is, and that's an interesting ask too, that occurs to me is that they have a strange structure in Vallejo where only the chief and the deputy chiefs, two only three people can be outside hires there, and everybody else has to be promoted within. Everything up to the captain level is within the Police Officers Association, the union. So that's actually kind of unusual for a police department to have people in that management level be in the union. And so I think that if they were able to bring in kind of outside leadership in some of those top positions, so getting those out of the union actually could, have an impact.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.